Hello, welcome to our session. Today's session will focus on an explanation and defense of the Reagan Strategic Program, which will be presented by our panel. The Reagan Strategic Program, you'll be finding out quite a bit about. It's the official policy of the Reagan administration, particularly with regard to strategic nuclear weapons. That's what we'll be explaining. We'll start out with, I'll give an introduction. Then my three colleagues will expound on the various parts of the strategic program, and then we'll have a time for discussion.
Tell me what strategic weapons
do. Joel.
Usually strategic is used as a term opposite that of tactical. It means a larger scale strategic policy is policy for an all-out exchange between superpowers.
Since we'll be working from a presentational format to begin with, we'd like you to hold your questions and comments until we're done. So that'll be pretty obvious when we're done. I'll give a conclusion, and then you'll know that we're done. And then we'll have a time for a discussion, and at that time I'll give you some guidelines for that discussion. So, the Reagan Strategic Program. First question, why do we need a Reagan Strategic Program at all? Why do we need any kind of a strategic program? There's one prime reason, and a very good one, a very big one, a very powerful one, and that is the Soviet Union, which poses a very huge threat to the United States and to the United States allies, particularly our European allies. Soviet communism is expansionist in its very nature. Marx based his entire ideology on a world movement toward the takeover of the entire world by communism. Lenin, who was the primary shaper of Soviet communism, reinforced that and made it even more militaristic than Marx did originally. That's been backed up ever since the Soviet Revolution by just pages and pages and hours of Soviet propaganda. It's pretty easy to identify looking at Soviet history that they are indeed an expansionist nation and that the goal of their ideology is world conquest. But we don't have to rely just on their on reading Marx or Lenin to know whether or not the Soviet is really in this for sure. They mean business in it. We can look at Soviet activities, very recent activities, such as the invasion of Afghanistan, which is awfully blatant, Soviet activity throughout the Third World, places like El Salvador, and most recently in Poland. The way that they worked is so that it looks like the Polish government is acting on its own. It's pretty obvious to just about everybody that the Soviets were heavily involved and they're heavily influencing Poland. They're always conducting military maneuvers right around the area. Soviets are intent on controlling the area immediately around them and eventually the entire world. They pose a threat. They pose a threat also to the United States. We can not only look at their propaganda, their ideology, not only at their recent military activities, but also at their growing military, particularly nuclear, arsenal. They have for a long time had a very adequate ability to destroy the United States with nuclear weapons. This is something that I hope makes everybody in this room afraid. Being blown up by nuclear weapons is not a cool thing. It's something we want to avoid. Now, not only have they had for a long time the ability to destroy the entire United States, but they have continued to build. Not only have they continued to build, but they have been accelerating their building program, accelerating their spending. In the last decade, the Soviets have accelerated their spending by 50%. They just keep rolling and rolling and rolling. Not only are they expanding with the same weapons, they are making their weapons more powerful, more accurate. The Soviets have always leaned toward more powerful, more megatonnage in their nuclear weapons than the United States. Now they're moving to increase the accuracy of their weapons, which indicates that they are interested in a first strike capability to the United States. Just last Tuesday, well, the Tuesday before this last, the Soviets threatened to deploy nuclear weapons just off the coast of the United States. The only reason they'd want to do this is for first strike capability. It's something that we should all be very concerned about, very afraid of, and it's something that we need to respond to. It's incredibly naive to say that the Soviets do not pose a threat to the security of the United States. When a country has so many nuclear weapons, so powerful, such powerful weapons aimed at our territory and at our allies, they are posing a threat to us. There's no rational denial of that. The Reagan strategic program builds deterrence and defense capabilities to counter the Soviet threat. I'd like to distinguish between deterrence capabilities on the one hand and defense capabilities on the other hand. Deterrence is based on the principle that we want to keep the Soviets from ever attacking us in the first place. The key factor in adequate deterrence is survivability of nuclear survivability. The key factor in deterrence is the survivability of our weapons aimed at the USSR. We want to have enough of our weapons able to survive a first strike by the Soviets that we can still, after a Soviet first strike, attack the Soviet Union and inflict unacceptable losses on their population. This is the way that we deter the Soviet Union, because if they know that if they hit us, we're going to blow them off the face of the earth, they're not so likely to blow us up. Okay? It's very simple, very basic, and fairly stable for the most part. It's worked so far. It's worked for ever since the Soviets have had their weapons. The Reagan strategic program will double the amount of United States nuclear weapons that can reach the Soviet Union after a Soviet attack. In that way, the Reagan strategic program increases our deterrence capabilities. We have more weapons, we will have twice as many weapons that will survive the Soviet attack and can head back over to the Soviet Union. That's deterrence. If they know we're going to blow them up, they're not going to attack. Now, because we don't know the minds of the Soviet leaders, because of the increasing aggression of the Soviets throughout the world, because of all kinds of extraneous factors, we don't know for sure that the deterrence will work. There's increasing evidence that the Soviets are interested in a first strike, and so what we also not only have to be prepared to deter a Soviet attack, but we also have to be prepared to defend ourselves in the event of an actual Soviet first strike. If our deterrence fails, we have to be able to defend ourselves. We can't just put all our eggs in the one basket of deterrence. I'd like to read a quotation by Caspar Weinberger. He just wrote this February 24th. It's very recent. It deals with the idea of defense and deterrence, how they relate to each other, and what the United States policy is on them. In stressing the importance of change, that is the change in our policy, I do not wish to belittle the substantial continuities in our policy. The United States remains committed to a defensive use of military strength. Our objective is to deter aggression or to respond to it should deterrence fail. That's our defense. Should deterrence fail, we need defense. Our objective is not to initiate warfare. This stance has been fundamental to U.S. national strategy for a long time. But what is new in our defense policy is that we now realistically face the implications of this defensive stance. Since the United States will not strike first, our military forces must be prepared to react after the enemy has seized the first initiative, and to react so strongly that our counterattacks will inflict unacceptably high cost on the enemy and thus deter their initial strike. So by achieving the ability to defend ourselves after a first strike, that's also a part of our deterrence, and it helped our increased defensive capabilities help to alleviate the possibility of a nuclear war, which is the goal of all of us. We don't want a nuclear war. The scenario that we look at most often and that the Reagan strategic program is trying to deal with is a very scary one. It's often called the blackmail scenario. It works like this. The Soviets launch a first strike of nuclear weapons onto the United States. Their first strike would be aimed at United States military targets, that is, our ICBM, ballistic missiles aimed at the Soviet Union. They'd want to knock out our ICBMs and in a large proportion of our land-based bombers. After doing that, the Soviet Union would make demands on the United States. Okay, say either withdraw from Europe or any number of, they could make any number of rotten, horrible demands on the United States. Okay, the United States president is then left with only two options. Okay, we've been hit by a Soviet first strike that has knocked out land-based missiles and a good number of our bombers. U.S. president has two options. One is to retaliate through submarine-based missiles. Our current submarine-based missiles are not accurate enough to hit Soviet missile silos. They're only accurate enough to destroy cities. So the president could, one, retaliate on the Soviet cities through submarine-based missiles and destroy the population of the Soviet Union. One option. The other option would be to concede to the Soviets' demands. That puts the President of the United States in an extremely poor position. Either concede or blow up the Soviet Union. It is imagined that the President would probably have to concede to the Soviets rather than blow up all of their people, in which case the Soviets would probably respond by blowing up all of ours. So the president would have to be a total madman bent on the destruction of all the population in the Northern Hemisphere in order to pick the one response. His only other response would be to concede to the Soviet demands. The Reagan strategic program is geared toward increasing our options in that kind of a situation so that the president would have more than an either-or choice, each of which would be very unacceptable. We want to increase our options in the event of a Soviet attack. Arms reduction. The Reagan administration is very interested in arms reduction. It's not as simple a problem as it may look. A lot of people say, well, just stop producing arms. That's not so easy. We want to negotiate arms reduction treaties with the Soviet Union. There are only two positions from which we can negotiate. We can negotiate from a position of power over the Soviet Union, or we can negotiate from a position of weakness. Parity is so hard to define that we're never going to say there's parity when the Soviet Union says there's parity, and the Soviet Union will never say there's parity when we say there's parity, so that's really not an option. We have to negotiate from power or from weakness. If the Soviets are ahead of us, if the Soviets have superior strategic nuclear power, they're not going to want to negotiate arms reduction. They're going to like the situation the way it is. Any reductions that they would propose would only be to further the Soviet advantage. And in a position of power, they might even be able to force us into very unacceptable terms for arms reduction. That leaves us with only one choice for negotiating arms reductions, and that is from a position of the United States power. It would greatly increase the Soviet incentive for arms reduction. Seeing all of the arms that we have, they would want to decrease arms, naturally. And we would be able to get much more favorable terms favorable to the United States rather than the Soviet Union. Arms control is a goal of the United States. I'd like to read from Alexander Haig, a statement he made last summer. There is little prospect of agreements with the Soviet Union that will help solve such a basic security problem as the vulnerability of our land-based missiles until we demonstrate that we have the will and the capacity to solve them without arms control, should that be necessary. It's another way of saying that the Soviet Union is not going to negotiate arms reductions until they have to. And the Soviet Union will not be interested in negotiating arms reductions until the United States has superior nuclear forces. The Reagan strategic program, which we were about to move into in more detail, is composed of five mutually reinforcing elements. First, improvements in communications and control systems. Second, modernization of strategic bombers. Third, deployment of new Soviet-launched deployment of new submarine-launched missiles. Fourth, a step-by-step plan to improve the strength and accuracy of new land-based missiles and to reduce their vulnerability. Fifth, improvements in strategic defense. Through these 5 points, the Reagan strategic program will ensure, more than ever before, peace in our time. It greatly strengthens our deterrence of nuclear war by denying the Soviets any realistic prospects, however the Soviets may define them, of gaining an advantage by initiating the nuclear weapons. We all fear the horrors of nuclear war. The Reagan strategic program greatly decreases the likelihood of nuclear war and provides for the maintenance of peace for many years to come.
Okay. I'm going to tell you about the Reagan program for communication and control systems. And first I'm going to make a short description. And we've got three main things. The first thing we want to do is improve our radars and our satellites' survivability. For example, our satellites, they will be able to estimate better the size of a missile attack from Russians. And the radars will be able to discover better any operation of submarines around the US. Secondly, we want to improve the command centers that would direct US strategic forces during a war. For example, the air base command post serving military commands would be hardened against nuclear effects. And that's, for example, what President Reagan will be upping if we have a first strike from Russians. And three, we want to make survivable communications that can link command centers with all three legs of the triad after a first strike from the Russians. And the triad is the ICBMs, the submarines, and the bombers. The reason why we want to do that is, first, we want, and that's radars and satellites, we want to have a timely warning. We have to know what's coming towards us to find out what to send back. That's obvious. And two, after the first attack, it will be needed to have a system that could give information and commands to triad. And three, we haven't kept our control and communication program update, so the system we have now would have no chance of operating after a nuclear attack from the Soviet Union. And that's what we're going to get. We're not going to attack them, but they might attack us. And that's why we need to have a communication and control system that will work after that first strike. And we don't have that today. Okay. Then the Reagan bomber program. The description. We've got three different kind of bombers. We've got the B-1 bomber. And what we're going to do is that we're going to develop a variant of that B-1 bomber, and we'll put that in use in 1986. Secondly, we're going to continue a research and development program for the advanced technology bomber, so we would be able to deploy that one in the 1990s. And three, the newer B-52s, the B-52s that are in use now, will be changed so they can carry cruise missiles. We'll deploy 3,000 cruise missiles on the new B-52s, and the older ones will be withdrawn in 1982-83. The reason why we need these two new bombers, the B-1 and the B-52, is, first, there's a general consensus on the need of bombers. We need the B-1 because it can bolster us through the critical 1980s, and we need the advanced technology bomb to make sure that the US can penetrate any Soviet air attack in the next century. So, the B-1, we've got the B-1 now, but we're gonna develop a variant of it, so we can put that in use in the 1986. And that'll give us time enough to work on the advanced technology bomb that would help us into the next century.
And three.
Well, that was number two. And three, the B-1 bomber, when we've got the advanced technology bomb, will we be able to penetrate the Soviet defensibility initially? And when this advanced technology bomb is deployed, it can be used as a cruise missile. So, if I sum it up, we'll need the B-1 in the 80s and the B-52 in the 90s. And that's about it.
Okay, the third element of the Reagan program is deployment of new submarine-launched missiles. The Reagan program for sea-based forces will first continue the construction of Trident ballistic missile submarines at a rate of one per year. The second component for sea-based forces is the development of Trident II. Okay, the Trident II, the D-5 missile, is a larger and more accurate sea-launched ballistic missile, which will be ready for deployment on the Trident submarines beginning in 1989. Thirdly, the Reagan program will deploy in 1984 several hundred nuclear-armed sea-launched cruise missiles on general-purpose submarines. Okay, some of the reasons. The U.S. and Soviet strategic arsenals comprise a three-legged triad of forces based on land, sea, and air. The program has been constructed because sea-based forces represent the most survivable leg of our strategic triad. The Reagan program expands these forces for a number of reasons. The new D-5 missile is designed to carry more warheads than current C-4 submarine-launched missiles. When the capability of each Trident is increased, the U.S. will avoid a reduction in sea-based capabilities when existing Poseidon submarines must be retired in the 1990s. The new D-5 missile has been designed with better accuracy than current sea-based missiles. If necessary, this development will allow the U.S. to use sea-launched missiles to attack any target in the Soviet Union. Okay, the Reagan administration realizes that a key part of the U.S. deterrent posture is a strategic reserve force. Therefore, to maintain this, the Reagan program will place cruise missiles on existing attack submarines. The administration also sees a very critical need to deploy ground-launched cruise missiles and the Piercing II ballistic missile to counter the massive Soviet buildup of theater nuclear forces in Europe. I'm next going to outline the Reagan administration's step-by-step approach to land-based missile modernization. Okay, the Reagan step-by-step approach to intercontinental ballistic missile modernization will include the cancellation of multi-protective shelter basing for the MX missile. The second step will be to continue with the development and deployment of at least 100 MX missiles. By 1984, the third step of the program will go into effect. At this time, the modernization program will have three options for deployment. The first of the three long-term basing alternatives for MX is an invulnerable aircraft that will launch MX. The second option will give active defense to land-based missiles, and deep underground basing of MX is the third basing option for MX. Okay, the last component, active defense to land-based missiles.
I'll talk about
it. Okay. Deep underground basing of MX is the third basing option. The last component of the Reagan ICBM modernization program is the deployment of MX in Titan or Minuteman silos. Okay, some of the reasons for this. The MX program has been redesigned because of military drawbacks in the Carter administration's plan to conceal MX. The previous administration planned to conceal MX by moving the missiles among thousands of SOF shelters. Proposed research and development programs will provide alternative basing for MX. These programs will ensure greater survivability than the multiple protective shelter basing. Okay, so the basic premise here is that the current shelters are not survivable against today's threat. Okay, the three alternative basing modes are necessary because they will give far greater survivability than multiple protective shelter basing. In 1986, the MX missile will be complete, which is well ahead of its long-term basing. Therefore, initial deployment in existing ICBM silos is necessary to avoid delaying MX. It is vital that MX is not again delayed. It is a stronger and more accurate missile than Minuteman. The early deployment of MX will break the Soviet monopoly on prompt counter ICBM capabilities. OK, Okay, and finally, the program for reconstruction and improvement of these silos will be a greater safeguard against nuclear effects.
The fifth part of the Reagan strategic program is the program for strategic defense. As the Soviet arsenal grows and becomes more sophisticated, our deterrence force is at risk. To maintain our deterrence, we need a program of strategic defense, which means to actively intercept and neutralize Soviet first strike weapons aimed against our arsenals. The reasons for the program are in the past decade, we have virtually ignored strategic defense systems. We just haven't paid any attention to the deployment of such systems. As a result, we have large gaps in the North American Air Defense Warning Network. Our strategic air defense interceptors are obsolete, and our anti-satellite and ballistic missile defense programs have lagged behind the development of Soviet satellite guidance and satellite weapons platform development. The Reagan program ends these years of neglect. We've taken the first steps toward restoring credible strategic defense forces. In the years ahead, we plan to continue our review of strategic defense to determine what additional steps may be needed. Here's a description of the points of the strategic defense development. We plan to upgrade in coordination with Canada the North American Air Surveillance Network. The plan will include some combinations of new over-the-horizon backscatter radars and improved versions of the ground radars that exist today. We'll replace 5 squadrons of aging F-106 interceptors first deployed 1956 with new F-15s, first developed and put in the air in 1972. We plan to buy at least 6 additional AWACS, that's airborne warning and control systems, airborne surveillance aircraft for North American defense to augment ground-based radars in peacetime and to provide surveillance and control interceptors in wartime. The AWACS are a development which greatly augments our ability to know what's going on in the air anywhere in the United States or on the frontiers. The new Soviet weaponry and guidance of their air-launched missiles and especially their strategic bombers makes it difficult to track them with ground-based radar. The AWACS are an airborne surveillance and data processing system that can give almost immediate identification of every aircraft, friendly or alien, in a 200-mile radius. The airplanes are capable of flying for 12 hours at a time and are such a drastic improvement in our surveillance system that we found they're necessary even though they are very expensive. We will continue, the fourth point, we will continue to pursue an operational anti-satellite system. Satellites are used for two purposes. Now they're being used as possible guidance input for missiles that will be targeted while en route, meaning the targets can be changed depending upon the satellite sensing anti-missile devices and defense deployments. And so it's necessary that those kind of surveillance and guidance satellites be eliminated in the event of a war or attack. Research and development of ballistic missile defense will be vigorously pursued. Already mentioned the hardening of the silos under the ICBM modernization Laura talked about. We'll expand ballistic missile defense research and development for active defense of land-based missiles. Essentially, that's continuing our research and development of the anti-ballistic missile. The deployment of that was agreed. Well, both the Soviet Union and the United States agreed not to deploy beyond a certain number a system of anti-ballistic missiles in the SALT I agreement. Essentially, the negotiations for that posture have continued in SALT II. However, there are reason to believe that in order to preserve our deterrent, we have to be able to intercept Soviet warheads aimed at our arsenal, and to be able to intercept them with anti-ballistic missiles to preserve our assured destruction of the capability. We'll develop technologies for space-based missile defense in response to Soviet developments, and we will have an expanded, cost-effective civil defense program. Will be developed in coordination with the Federal Emergency Management Agency. We have neglected for a decade the very humane and necessary issue of the defense of non-combatants. Realistically, it's very difficult to achieve that with the kind of yield that the warheads can produce, but to ignore the defense of non-combatants is rather irresponsible. So we will begin looking at options for civil defense, and we'll pursue other related programs and objectives. That's the Reagan Program for Strategic Defense.
In concluding, I'd like to highlight just a few things that we've just gone over in the 5 points. The first part of the program, improvements in communications and control systems, is based on the increasing the survivability of our information and communication systems. Currently, our entire program has been based on deterrence. The problem with our past policies is they have focused only on deterring a Soviet attack, and they've assumed that attack will never come, which kind of cancels itself out. Because if we are not ready to fight a war after the Soviets attack us, that invites the attack. For this reason, we are increasing particularly submarines, because they are the most survivable of the nuclear triad, of the strategic triad. If we put all of our accurate missiles on the land, where they are the most vulnerable and they are wiped out, we're left with no accurate missiles left, unless we put them into the Trident system underneath the sea. Same with the MX missile. We are looking for increased accuracy. I want to ask a question about accuracy. If you have a nuclear weapon, would you rather, and you want to be humane about its use, would you rather be destroying a city with it? You want to destroy a city of millions of people, or a military target? A more accurate missile, which can be aimed at a military target, is inherently more humane than one that has to be aimed at a city. Plus, it's inherently a defensive measure. If the Soviets are to attack us first, the first thing we want to do is to protect our people by taking away the Soviets' ability to continue to attack us. How do we do this? Not by blowing up their cities, by blowing up their missile silos so that they can't attack us anymore. That's why we need more accuracy. The final part, the improvements in strategic defenses, that part kind of ties all the rest together, increasing information systems and increasing, well, everything that Joel told you about. Again, it's based on the principle that in order to deter war, we have to be prepared to fight war. An inability to fight a war is inviting an attack from an aggressive nation. Now, we're going to take some discussion. We'd like to keep this in a panel format. That is, we don't want things among you to be bantering it back up amongst you. We'd like to be questions to the panel, and then we'll respond to the question, and then if you have a response in the form of another question, that's fine. But we're going to try to keep a pretty tight rein on that. Christy.
Could you go into more, you said something about the Russians threatening blow a nuclear weapon off of our coast last Tuesday.
That was in Brezhnev's so-called unilateral freeze, which he was calling for us to stop deploying missiles in Europe while they have 200 aimed at. They have 200 missiles in close range of Europe, aimed at Europe, and they were going to offer to not deploy 100 more if we never started deploying weapons in Europe. Then he followed that up with a direct threat that if we did not respond to his so-called freeze in the way that he wanted us to, then he was going to deploy nuclear weapons right off of our coast.
That does not mean blow them up. That just means base them.
Okay.
Where was he did that?
He didn't specify. It's thought either in Cuba, maybe somewhere in Central America, or possibly submarines off the Pacific coast. Bridget.
Tim, you talked about positions of power and weakness in terms of negotiating. Who is in the position of power right now?
It's real close. It's hard to say. The Soviets have, there was a time, say pre-1960, when the United States was clearly ahead. Since that time, the United States, in relationship to the Soviet Union, has slowed down its production of nuclear weapons, and the Soviet Union has sped up. They've been greatly increasing. So right now, some people think the Soviets are ahead, some people think it's about even. But there's clearly not U.S. superiority right now. Okay, Linda, then Jerry.
Yeah, Tim, you were talking about the need to increase accuracy and that kind of thing, and why we have more sea-based, or we're working on the Trident and that kind of thing, and you keep stressing that it is so that we can do the more humane thing by hitting missile silos instead of hitting cities, but that this is still after a Soviet attack. Well, if the missiles are already gone, what's the point? It seems to me like that's a real belligerent thing to do, and that what you're talking about is a first strike capability and not a retaliatory capability.
No, we're not talking about blowing up the empty Soviet missile silos.
Yeah.
That would be foolish. If the Soviets launch a first strike attack on us, they're not going
to
be sending over all of their 20,000 nuclear weapons.
How do you know which ones will be sent?
Through the kinds of things Joel was talking about. You want to explain surveillance?
Peter mentioned increased surveillance. It is possible with our technology to pinpoint the Soviet silos and ICBMs, and to be able to launch a weapon within 300, 500 feet of each of those targets is achievable goal.
Yeah, we can tell which ones have been fired and which haven't. Terry.
I have three questions. My first thing is I'd like to compliment the panel. I think you did a very fine job of presenting the previous proposals. And I'd like to address all of them to you, Tim. The first thing I'd like to ask is, will the United States admit to rough parity at this point? The second thing I'd like to ask on the okay, go ahead and answer that first, I guess.
Oh, no, that's not the one, because I wasn't here. Parity, as I said before, is such a hard thing to define. It's hard to say what it is. Right now, it depends on who you talk to in Washington. Some will say that the Soviets have caught up. Some will say the Soviets have passed us. Everybody says if the Soviets continue in the same direction, they will very soon be far ahead of us.
But the question I have is, does, if rough parity exists, is well, now the time to talk about arms reductions or limitations? The second thing I have to ask is...
You're going
to
ask that question one at a time.
Forget that.
Well, I'll answer it.
That's right.
Parity is not the time to negotiate, according to the Reagan Doctrine.
Parity is not the time to negotiate, partly because it's so hard to define, partly because we can't be assured of getting acceptable terms for the United States, and also we are not at parity now in that you can't take one particular situation. Arms reductions talks aren't going to happen today or tomorrow. They're going to happen over the course of a couple years, and if during that time we continue the same trends that we're on right now, we're going to be behind by the time the arms control negotiations have been achieved.
Because
now what's your next question?
What I do have is, if we cannot expect, if we refuse to negotiate from a position of weakness and need to negotiate from a position of power, how can we expect them to negotiate in a position of weakness?
Well, they'll have to if we're strong enough.
No, we don't have to negotiate now. We feel we're in a position of weakness. That's why I'm saying this. Either side is feeling...
Well, that's because it's close enough now. When it's very close, nobody's going to want to negotiate. When there's a significant a difference, as there was in 1960 when the United States had been concentrating for a number of years on its nuclear weapons, before the decade of neglect over the 70s, before that, the United States had been building up. It had been putting its resources into this as a matter of a very important cause of national security. If we restore that cause to its proper place, then we will be able to achieve the superiority.
Another thing, too, is that, that all signs point to an inability of the Soviet economic system to maintain the pace with us. And so it's probably a realistic goal to achieve superiority.
Okay. I'll get you a second, Eric, and Libby. Then Gino has something.
I didn't quite understand what Joel said. If the Soviets can keep up, how can they become superior?
I say they can't. Their economic system can't handle that.
Can't support it. You have something, Gino?
Well, yeah, this is just another quote from Kasper Weinberger on the same paper that Tim read, and it said, this administration does not regard nuclear strength as a substitute for conventional strength. He is, it's a follow-up from something else, but he said, and while we do not seek nuclear superiority for the United States, by the same token, we will make every necessary effort to prevent the Soviet Union from acquiring the superiority that would mistakenly and tragically lead them to believe a first try by them could even succeed.
Oh, Kasper, why?
That's simply at odds with our strategic plan here.
Eric?
Joel. I was going to just, as a background, I realized that your administration can't, isn't responsible for accounting for the actions of earlier administrations, but at a time when we were clearly superior, far and away superior in nuclear weaponry, why weren't there reduction talks then? The best that I can recall happening, say, in the Kennedy years, was an agreement not to test nuclear weapons above ground. And that was seen as a great breakthrough. But why, I mean, the logic behind the logic behind your argument should have meant, should mean that we would have had successful arms reduction talks way back in the 50s or early 60s at the latest, when there was precisely the situation that you want to reattain.
Well, I think you answered the question yourself when you, at the very beginning, when you said that we're not responsible for previous administrations. There's no telling why they were doing the things they were doing then.
You're referring to General Eisenhower, that fine Republican? Ross? Ron?
Well, another possible response would be, has to do with the Soviet psychology, that attempts at negotiation were tried. There were many points that we pressed for in SALT I that the Soviets wouldn't agree to. It was a start, but we found that the other side is difficult to negotiate with.
But I think if we look at something like the Cuban Missile Crisis, we can see that in that event, the United States clearly was in a position of power. We knew it, the Soviet Union knew it. Now, if we were in a similar position today, with our emphasis now on arms reductions, then we could use that same power, which could turn the Soviet ships back when Kennedy was president. We could use that same U.S. power now to reduce arms. Libby?
I'll just respond to that. Well, I don't think we were in a position of power. I read a quote today from Robert Kennedy's memoirs, watching his brother the day of the Cuban Missile Crisis. There was no power in that.
Soviets thought we had power. Isn't that what is important?
Anyway, my question is, Joel mentioned about the economy and the Soviet inability to sustain. Levism is a big word. And arms acceleration, and I wonder about our own economy with recent Gallup polls of the majority of people in the United States feel that the major concern of our country is the economy and rising unemployment. And with unemployment rising to 22% in Detroit, I'm wondering how long we could sustain such a rate, and if the public mandate is going to allow, public opinion to allow that.
Administration would probably answer it's up to the Congress to pass the budget cuts and up to Chairman Volcker to get his foot off the neck of the economy.
I think we have to also ask what our options are. Our other options could be well, what is the economy going to be like under communist rule? It's certainly not going to be very favorable to the people who have the money now, us. What is the economy going to be like if our cities have been destroyed by nuclear weapons? Our economy today is just infinitely better than it is in either of those two situations.
You disagree? Who disagrees with that? Who disagrees that our economy would be better after a nuclear annihilation?
I noticed that most of the people before abortion have already been born.
I'd like to support what Tim said.
Okay,
I'd
David?
Like to support what Tim said. Our economy is healthier when we're producing weapons. We employ half of the trained technical people in defense. And if we did massive cutbacks in defense, those people would all be out of work. And address yourself.
Yeah. You have a question, Dave? Okay, Libby? Or I don't mean Libby, Christy?
Well, first off, wouldn't the Russians use that argument too, saying no matter how bad their economy is, would it not be better for them to have an economy of sorts rather than to be blown up? Couldn't they use the same argument you gave?
For living under Washington rule.
Yeah, living under...
Part of the difference is that their ideology insists that they blame the capitalistic world for their problems. I mean, we are ideologically the scapegoat for communistic difficulties. And so it's very consistent that they would look to an aggressive, belligerent military policy in order to remove the capitalistic menace from the world. And it's just a question of how serious we believe they are about that ideology. And we aren't in the position where we blame them for our economy. We look at it as rather independent of what they're doing.
Eric?
Hey, I'd like to get back to Tim's response to my original question, because it raised an even graver problem. That is, you refuse to accept accountability for what, say, John Kennedy or Eisenhower did. And this, from the Russian point of view, raises serious doubts about negotiating at all, because we've noticed over the last 10, 20 years that the American people tend to vote parties in and out of the presidency, every 4 years, and presidents tend to repudiate the contract, the agreements of previous presidents, that no competing president assumes responsibility for agreements that his predecessor has made. What Jimmy Carter does, Jimmy Carter does, and 4 years later, that's all in the wind. And the breakdown of the SALT agreements is a beautiful illustration of that sort of thing. So why bother going to the table with any American president or administration and negotiating an arms control agreement, since, given the American system, some new dingbat out of Nevada will be elected who will decide that he's going to revamp and say, well, that was Ronald Reagan, I'm doing something else.
One of the major problems, as you've been saying, through the entire history of nuclear development in the United States has been our kind of patchwork approach to strategic weapons and policy. It's been one president here, one president there. It's always been for the moment, maybe even for last year. We've never been projecting into the future something that is going to hold together, something that the Soviets know is going to be happening, something that we know is going to be happening. I'd like to read from the introduction, from the overview of the Reagan Strategic Program. The Reagan Program will determine to a large extent U.S. strategic capabilities into the next century. Not since the Eisenhower years his administration proposed a nuclear program of such breadth and scope. We have used this unique opportunity to mold a strategic force that will meet the objectives of our strategy and serve as a coherent instrument of national policy. So if we have a coherent program that covers not just this year and maybe next year up through next April, but we have something that's going to cover us all the way through the next century, till to the next century. And in that way, that will serve as that instrument and it will provide that continuity. Linda, you had a question before.
Oh, yeah. I have a question of Mr. Ornister. You're talking about civil defense. I have a question which sort of depends on your expanding on that. Do you mean after our cities are devastated, then civil defense protecting them against the Russians who are coming into our city? Or are you talking about protecting people by not blowing them up, or what are you saying?
Of course, pursuing negotiations and deterrence to prevent the war is the best. But civil defense, as far as protecting people immediately before and during an attack, is what's meant by civil defense. And it is not in a very, very good position right now because of its neglect. And there's a lot of work left to be done on it.
Are you talking about shelters? Or
primarily, it would consist of two aspects. It's evacuation of targeted areas and shelters to protect against thermal blast, radiation, and fallout.
Okay, Jerry?
Yeah. Something just in reaction to Eric, I noticed that the thing that,
Jerry, can you keep your comments to just
just to what Eric was asking? I was just going to say that I noticed that the paper you read mentioned the Eisenhower policy, which is now totally not respected by the Reagan administration, was the most long-lasting and far-reaching policy on nuclear weapons. Anyway, the question I'd like to ask is, you said that the stated policy is we will not strike first, then why is there... why we refuse to sign up statements in that effect?
I'm not real familiar with the situation.
Well, okay, you mentioned that the stated policy was we will not strike first.
Right.
And the Congress has repeatedly refused to sign a declaration that we will not strike first.
Well, I mean, if we do that, we won't have anything to negotiate about. I mean, if we sign a thing like that, there's no way we could do that with the Soviet, with the Russians around. I mean, that would be plain stupid.
Plus, it's not possible to predict the future. We don't want to tie the hands of future American presidents. Dan. Dan,
question about security. If we completely close the window of vulnerability, so we're in a position strength and position to first strike to destroy all the Soviet ability to strike us. So at that point we would be technically secure. When we reach that point, and at the same time a billion people on this earth are underfed, many of those starving, nations all over the world rising, the rich nations of the world getting richer, the poor getting poorer, the poor in our own country in the ghettos becoming more and more impatient with their lot. Now, how could you ever say at that point we've reached what we would call security when all of these volatile realities would still be at work in the world and directed against them?
Okay, I'll take it then. Security. It seems to me that nuclear security is a very fundamental security, in that if the millions of starving people in the world right now are victims of nuclear fallout, they are going to be very insecure indeed. And it won't make any difference if they're starving or if they're well-fed and have two cars. The first thing we have to do is keep them from getting blown off the face of the earth. Then we can start working on their problems. Not that we're not working on their problems now. But if they're blown off the face of the earth, they're not secure at all. It's a very fundamental security that we're talking about.
Okay.
I agree that you are just deeply sensitive to me.
You're hostile.
One other question. Now, what you talking about nuclear security, a hostile group or a guerrilla group is hostile against us people, what would ever keep them from going under all of our sophisticated defenses and just by sabotage of doing the very thing that we feel so secure that we're protected against? Especially with the thought of the proliferation of their weapons, possibly in guerrilla groups sneaking into the country under all of our sophisticated defenses.
First of all, we are representatives of the Defense Department. There are other agencies working on other problems. Our specific focus is on defense. Second of all, the only 15% of the budget. Military budget is going toward the strategic program. The others are the maintenance of the conventional forces, which meet those sorts of guerrilla tactics and other sorts of conventional invasion, subversion, and that is an important concern of the Defense Department too. But that is outside the strategic.
Well, at the moment, we are more, there's a bigger risk that those guerrillas would succeed. If we get through with this, they won't have that big ability. I mean, we are making that smaller and smaller by doing what we're doing here. Because the weapons we have now are good enough for whatever you call it, for them to get in and blow us up. But if we could make them even better, make them even more sophisticated, we would make that possibility, that risk, smaller and smaller. And that's also part of what we do.
Okay, Peter?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions.
One.
Two?
One.
One. Mr. Rice, so you were talking about the need for an ABM system, referring out that we are currently
anti-ballistic missile.
Yes, currently obliged by treaty not to do so, but that our deterrence can require, are you suggesting that we would break the treaty to preserve our advantage, and what effect do you think might have on the Russian willingness to negotiate with us?
Reagan's strategic plan does not break the treaty in that it only works toward research and development, which was never prevented by the SALT I agreement. The research and development of anti-ballistic missiles has continued from that time. We would not, at this stage, deploy an active defense for land-based missiles, but it would be something that we would very seriously consider, depending on the Soviet belligerence.
Libby, you answered.
Have we talked about tactical weapons?
No, I don't think that's included in our program.
No, we're talking about the strategic plan.
That's a whole different thing. We haven't really looked into it.
Is there another panel in the screen or something?
Well, I did mention something about like some of the defense, the strategic defense include tactical fighters, interceptor air superiority fighters, which are made to intercept and shoot down bombers before they can drop their bombs on the United States. That those come out of a tactical air force.
Okay, here's my question. How do I trust the government's statement about not using any first strike business when 2 years ago Carter said in the State of the Union, when the crisis was in Iran and the Persian Gulf, that we would use any means necessary to hold our own and to protect our vital interests in the Persian Gulf area. And that implied a use of a tactical weapon because there was no use of any conventional stuff going on in that area.
We can look at what he used. He used a bunch of helicopters. I mean, that wasn't necessary. Nuclear weapons were not necessary in that situation.
So you think it was a bluff?
Well, I'm not sure that it was even implied, the nuclear weapons, for what he was talking about. And that's especially borne out in his actions. You had a question?
Yeah. Does all of this involve phasing out of current weapons, or are we just going to have more than we do now? Are some going to be declared obsolete and taken out of the system? We're just going to add more.
Yeah, some are obsolete. Ships will be mothballed. B-52s will be grounded. The development will be worn. A lot of tactical fighters will be down. I think the Titan and the Minuteman will be replaced by, to some extent, by the MX.
Okay. So what happens to an obsolete nuclear warhead?
Warheads, classified information. actually, it is possible to reprocess those warheads and to put them into a more accurate reentry vehicle and to really upgrade the raw materials for the group.
Okay. I have Linda, then Christy. Then Peter. Yeah.
I did have a question. If you're saying that you know the fundamental safety to protect these starving people from nuclear fallout, and then Peter was saying that the reason we want to pump more money into this is because what we have today is not good enough to detect their missiles and that sort of thing. But, I mean, do you agree that this thing can never stop and that we're going to keep increasing our budget so that there's no hope of helping starving people even as much as we are today, which is a little amount, because we're going to keep, pretty soon it'll be nuclear weapons in space, and it's not that we know that the Russians will just come right back and develop the same things we're developing. So why can't we be satisfied with blowing them up several times? I mean, you know what I'm saying? Starving people aren't safe when they're being, becoming radioactive, but they're not safe when they're dead, which is what may happen if we take more and more money away from social programs and from aid and that kind of thing, which is what's going to have to happen if we go into space, which is probably the next thing that'll happen. I mean, I know there are plans to go into space.
Well, I think this is going into a new topic again, because then you could start talking about what the Reagan program, everything that he stands for, would do to this society. I mean, it's supposed that if everything works out, in 5 years, we will be so much more healthier. And we will be able to give more money to the starving
people. How?
Well, I mean, that's a question of...
That's economical.
Yeah, taxes, and then you get people to invest more, and then you get,
triple.
So, yeah, you will have the state as a really wealthy society. And then we'll be able to give more to people.
And address one question you said, we already have overkill capability in our ICBMs. The changes in the sophistication of Soviet weapons means that those things in a first strike can be neutralized, and we can lose that arsenal.
Yeah.
And so it's necessary to develop more sophisticated weapons to counter that.
But then you realize that they will counter us with more sophisticated weapons, and then we'll have to keep going.
As much as they can, but as we were saying before, the Soviets cannot continue to do that forever. They're falling apart as it is.
So we can, right?
We can continue to do it more longer than the Soviets can. Our economy is a whole lot healthier. Okay, Christy.
I think it was you, Tim, that said that our high point in the arms race so far was in 1960, is that right?
I said that in 1960 we had clearly perceived superiority.
When did that start decreasing?
What, about somewhere in the 60s? Kind of with the Vietnam War, we were pumping a lot of money into there.
Okay.
the amount, the percentage of our gross national product and the percentage of our national total national budget in the 1960s that has gone to military has been decreasing ever since then. And as we were mentioning before, Joel said 15% of our military expenditures are for nuclear weapons, which is a very small proportion. That has been decreasing also, the amount that we're putting into nuclear weapons.
Since 1960, it's been decreasing?
I don't know what year it started.
Four.
Mid-60s, maybe 65 or something like that.
How much of that decrease after the Vietnam War was due to public sentiment? I mean, could that have been a factor in the decrease of our putting money into nuclear weapons?
I think it was, and I think that at least public opinion has reversed itself there, and Reagan was popularly elected on the platform of increasing defense spending, and so it's pretty obvious that that's what the American people want.
But in this case, at least public sentiment has something to do with the decrease.
I think so.
Thank you.
Okay, from 1955 to 1975, defense spending dropped from 51% of total government spending to 26.2% in 1975. Just some statistics.
Meanwhile, the Soviet expenditure continues to build, continues to build, continues to build.
As a percentage?
As a percentage. And while 15% of ours is spent on the weapons themselves, the Soviets spend 50%. They spend only a quarter on personnel. They're putting all their money into these huge bombs, while we're putting our money more into personnel and things like that. Tom?
Well, this is for anyone on the panel. It has to do with sort of with what Christine was saying, and I agree with her that the misinformed public were very damaging to our defense policy, especially during the Vietnam War and after, and continues even though the public opinion has changed somewhat, continues today because I've heard some very disturbing people talk about the opposite of what you're saying, that we need to freeze arms, we need to reduce arms to be safer. And I guess I wonder, does the Reagan administration have any plans to try to curtail or to deal with this communist back of unilateral disarmament or freezing? It's very disturbing.
I don't think it's specifically in the strategic program.
You're right. The misguided minority that's calling for nuclear freeze simply have a different opinion of Soviet psychology than the administration, and I think they're naive. And we will do our part to help keep the American public informed.
Okay, Peter, you've got a list. Carolina.
Yeah. I have one question related to what I've done. Correct me if I'm misinterpreting what you've been saying here. It's my understanding that we are not in first strike posture, and that our entire capability, accuracy, is either deterrence or defense. Is that not correct?
Could you say the last sentence again?
Our very first strike capability, or acquiring the capability to take out missile silos, is entirely for reasons of deterrence and defense.
Right.
Okay. What I'd like to ask the panel, anybody can take it, is under what circumstance do you feel the Soviets would be willing to risk the complete annihilation of their society, even if it was questionable, given the fact that we've always planned that we would do this, that we have used heavy combat weapons on civilian populations, that the limited strike that you're talking about is one which would already devastate this country. And you know that, and we know that, and they know that. Under what conceivable circumstance and for what possible gain, other than perhaps fear of our first strike, would prompt the Soviets to make that kind of threat?
Take it?
Well, I can say a couple things about that.
Okay.
First of all, they have flown in the face of world opinion and taken some very risky actions previously. Second, we are dealing with not the nation as a whole, but five or six leaders of the nation who make those decisions. And it's very difficult to predict what kind of motivation they would have to do it. The administration's argument is that if that is even a remote possibility, we would have to be ready to counter.
One of the key factors is what we call perceived power. If the Soviets think that they have more power than we are, they're liable to do it. In the same way, if they think we have more power than they are, they're less likely to do it. Eric.
This was dealing with your answer to my challenge originally when I said, and this is Soviet psychology, Soviets trying to figure us out. We have trouble figuring them out. And I said, well, from a Soviet point of view, why negotiate with this American president? The next American president will do something the opposite, and that next American president of just a couple years down the road. You responded by pointing to the continuity of our military buildup that says nothing to any possible continuity in arms reduction. I mean, the fact that you are proposing a development of arms, you know, into the next century does indicate a continuity of military expansion, but that doesn't deal with the problem of negotiating over the long haul into the next century, the reverse of that, which is arms reduction. And I don't see that your program guarantees that other continuity.
We have to look at it as a means to an end. We can't get the end until we have achieved the means for the arms reduction. So what we're working on now is the means to the arms reduction.
Yeah, and they might, you know, even if they agreed, they thought, well, gee, we'd really love arms reduction, and we're weak, and what, I mean, you know, we want it, but what if we go through all the trouble of negotiating that, and then you lose the election in 2 years, and your Democratic opponent gets in office and rethinks the whole thing?
For the last 20 years, we've had people committed to the end of, committed to some extent or another, to the end of arms reductions, but they've never had the means to achieve that because of this patchiness. If we give them the means to achieve them, then they'll be able to do it. They'll have the power to do it. Just a little past 9:30, so I'm just going to take people on my list, Carol and David.
Okay. I had a question. We see that Reagan's cabinet has internal dissent, as most cabinets have in the past, and this is a product, I guess, of the Department of Defense. My question is, what is the status of this in terms of Reagan's cabinet itself? I mean, is this really a unified front that we're seeing within the administration? Is there internal dissent? And secondly, within the Department of Defense, which will probably carry this thing through throughout the years, is there also internal dissent?
No, there's no dissent.
That's official. That may be a question after we,
breaking character.
No, I'm not breaking character.
Oh.
No, there is no internal.
Carol.
Oh, I think this is directly over here. Now, you were talking about communication systems and satellite systems within that. Now, would that mean that we would be negotiating with our allies and or countries that are strategically located to position such, you know, if we're going to build up our
are we going to increase the numbers in our countries or build up what we got here?
I don't know what I should just say. For example, that we improve our radars and satellites means that satellites will be able to estimate better what's coming. I mean, that has nothing to do. What I talked about, radar and satellites and communication and control systems, didn't really take in our allies. It was more, we can estimate what's coming, and that means that we'll know what to send back. And secondly, that we can discover what's going on around us. I don't know really whether that answered the question.
You're not saying you're not talking about that there needs to be any more deployment of any communication systems like in Europe that's not going to happen.
Well, yeah, that might improve it a lot. I mean, if but like satellites is not an arm in that sense. I mean, it's a thing that can if our allies in Europe are, I don't know, frightened or anything, they'll be able to send communication up to satellite and we'll be able to receive it. And also, this system will give us the ability of, after a first strike from the Russians, that the leaders of the army will be able to tell what's left, and we'll have something left, and that's an important thing too, what to do next. The system we have now will not enable, the system we have now will not make it possible that this communication could be passed on.
So you're saying that a lot of the countries that now would feel a fear or whatever would send signals up there.
They could do that now, but what we are making sure is that they can do it after first strike.
Okay, last question, David.
Sorry.
Is it okay if it's not a question but comment?
No.
Well, then it's more question. No, let me.
Okay, go ahead. Make a comment.
I was just going to say, well, it was partly to thank the group because I forget if it was yesterday or the day before's paper that just came in today. There's a front page article that talked about the Soviet use of nerve gas in Afghanistan. And the latest report shows that as many as 10,000 people in Afghanistan have been killed by nerve gas. And I just think that shows the Soviet respect for life. And the fact that we can't let that kind of stuff get too far gone. And I'm glad that you showed how forcefully the administration will deal with those sorts of
things. Okay.
I'd like to just drop the facade now. And just make a disclaimer.
We like it now.
We don't like ourselves. And I've learned a lot in doing this. We all have. And if you have any questions about what we've learned from it, I could just share a couple things. One is that most of my arguments originated in a different understanding of the Soviet psychology. And that you can say anything, develop any kind of scenario from a belligerent ideology that's opposed to our own. And that seems to be, there's enough vagueness there in our understanding of who the Soviets are and how their structure works that those things seem to be convincing. And David's right in saying that the behavior of the Soviets lends a lot of credibility to the administration's claim that they're very unpredictable and dangerous and would not avoid the use or engaging in nuclear war and perhaps a nuclear strike. I'm personally not content with that assessment of the Soviet psychology. But it's I think it's one of the ace in the hole of the administration and of anybody that advocates armed resistance, a strong military posture. The other thing about cost-effective civil defense program, nobody should have ever let me blame it on, you know, on previous administration, because the reason it has never been developed is because it's just impossible. Our nuclear capabilities on both sides make the non-combatants of both countries as vulnerable as the belligerent powers want them to be. There is no such thing as evacuation when...
Right.
Okay, but what are you going to come out to? Nothing but a devastated country and you're going to have to go. It's really not the time.
Okay. Well, that's what I was going to come back with something to that effect, but what I sort of learned from this is that people don't necessarily respond to logic because their own, I mean, not only do we miscalculate the Soviet mindset or have different opinions about it, but we have all these mindsets of our own which just totally disable communication. I mean, we were asking questions and saying, yeah, but that's not possible. And you were saying, but it is. And that's where you leave it. You can't go past that when you don't agree. Logic doesn't mean anything.
That's really true. We have to get peacemakers started pretty soon in order to get it out of the way before conflict. So, Garrick and Peter.
Yeah, it was just one thing that came out of it. Pursuing for a while, we were talking about Soviet psychology and us being baffled by them. My God, I would think if I were a Russian leader, I'd be out of my head trying to figure out America. And if you think of the personalities and policies and changes of direction that have taken place in this country at the top in the last 15 years, I wouldn't sign a paper with, you know, with any of those guys. It would, you know, burn it. It would be about that certainly.
Go ahead, Peter, and then I really think we have to stop.
Yeah, okay, I would also like to thank you. It's been a great job. It was very good. One thing I'd like to, I guess, point out, maybe it's very obvious, or maybe it isn't, that in this type of presentation, which is often the kind of thing that you come up against, you know, when you start talking related to people like this, you end up with like a partial argument, okay? And in the beauty of the nuclear issue as an issue is that if you go very far down that road, you get silliness almost every time. But what I would do is engage people beyond the statement of, well, we need the strength to negotiate what happens here, or go down the road of any of these scenarios for fighting a continued nuclear war, or what it means, you know, to be stronger or weaker, okay? I mean, just take some of those and move through it. Now, we can't do it on any of these things here, but many of the main arguments and defenses that have come out tonight, I think if we sat down in a small group and looked at one thing and had a chance to go through it, it would be very obvious where the balance is lying.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I think so.
Part of the strength.
You're hard to defend.
You said they were unredeemable yesterday.
Oh, I've been talking
about these things.
Part of the strength.
Yeah, that's fine. Part of the strength of being a panel like this is you can bluff.
You do it.
Yeah. Yeah, and you don't have to look like you're uncomfortable.
Like Bill sat there and said that you could blow out, you know, that they're going to be able to wipe out all our missiles. You know, well, it's absolutely blatantly untrue if you study your document. They have no belief that the Soviets can even threaten our submarines at this time. We've got tons of warheads out there, but you just, you know, in that format, you just say these things and they're not going
to. And the only way we can resist that is to know better than they do.
Yeah.
What's the reason for saying something
Let's
like that?
Cut this out so we can get started and just encourage everybody to look at two sides of an issue and not just one.
Good job.